Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research and unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by 97.9 FM, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health on WCHL.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And on our show today, Adam, we'll be talking with Dr. Julia Scatliff O'Grady, author of Good Busy, and talking about her pursuit of balance. I'm hoping to become more productive and balanced from the conversation.
Well, I don't know if you can be more productive and balanced.
That would be lovely. I think you can.
Yeah, well, these are hard questions here. Everyone's driven to succeed and do more, and yet we also all want balance. These are the questions she's dealing with in her book and has some incredible stories to tell. So I'm really looking forward to that conversation.
I am too. But first, Adam, we have some research that matters. We're going to talk about some of the mental health manual changes related to drinking alcohol,
which will imply whether people are abusing it or dependent, or maybe it doesn't matter anymore.
Talk about whether or not babies should be allowed to cry it out.
Do you remember if you were allowed to cry, Christy?
I don't remember that as well as I do with my own babies.
Well, that may have some implications. And we're going to also look at, if you're in the hospital and you get discharged, do you go back to urgent cares more frequently?
And finally, about whether diabetics underuse or appropriately use special footwear designed to prevent ulcers.
Let's dive right into this very first research that matters, Christy, about alcoholism, alcohol abuse, alcohol dependence. Some research that was in the journal Alcoholism.
Well, and this is pertaining to new criteria. Every so many years, they update this manual for mental health diagnoses called the DSM, and the new one will be the DSM-5. New criteria that helps to categorize problem drinking and alcoholism.
And in the new manual, alcohol use disorder is a single condition now. It used to be that you would differentiate between alcohol abuse and the more severe alcohol dependence.
One of the things that was revealed in this is some evidence suggesting that this new criteria would put 40% of college students listed as alcoholics, which is a little shocking.
It is. And I think part of the problem is that there is this binge drinking, and we know that it occurs in college students, it occurs in high school students, and many of us would say those who are binge drinking are abusing alcohol, but are they dependent on alcohol? Are they alcoholic? And what does it mean to label them? And she, in her research, Dr. Edwards from Virginia Commonwealth University, studied 7,000 paternal and identical twins and to see whether or not these new criteria would really improve. And I guess what they found is they pick up a lot more people as potentially being problematic, but they also pick up a lot more people.
Right. And I think it's important that this potentially opens up the dialogue more for people to have conversations with their providers and everyone with their parents, with their friends about appropriate drinking, misuse of drinking, risky drinking. But there is a risk of labeling someone for their whole life for something that may just be a little experiment or a little phase. And so that is tricky.
It is tricky. I was talking with some children very near and dear to me, Christy, who are both in college recently. And I was talking about there's something called an Audit 9, and it's a questionnaire that looks at alcohol use. Lots of questions on there. And we were talking about it, and they said, Dad, this describes half of all of the kids that we know, you know, who would score really high on this. And exactly as you said, it gave us a conversation to say, well, this is potentially problematic for some of you, some of them. Let's have a conversation.
Well, and we ought not to just look the other way. I mean, college drinking and binge drinking is a real problem that we need to continue to work to address for safety and other reasons. But I think this is going to be the beginning of hopefully more dialogue on the topic as we try to find a common ground.
We want people to give us the right answers the true answers, but we also have to be careful because if we put things in their medical records that then they get denied for insurance or they get denied for other things, that can create barriers in a healthcare system. A lot more to say on this. Let's go to our next research that matters, though, about babies and crying. Should you let them cry or should you not let them cry?
Did you let them cry? Do you remember It's probably a better question for your wife.
I think that probably for the first child, Christy, we did not let them cry. But the time the third one came along, we said, you know what? They're going to be just fine. Let them cry. What about you?
We did some blend. I didn't realize how hard it would be to have a baby crying and not go to them. But we did some modified version of letting them cry some so they could learn to fall asleep. But this is some evidence that's some new studies. And I think before we even go to them, I have to say the studies on this is so hard to know what a baby's really feeling, how much of this crying is just necessary brain development, how much of it really is going to impact them long term or short term. It's a really muddy and murky area of research.
Well, and so there was a study that was reported in the journal Developmental Psychology where they followed over 300 children, and half these children were in this sleep group that had some sort of training, and the other half did not. And then they followed these kids for several years out and basically found that there was very little difference, suggesting perhaps that those babies who were allowed to cry it out did just as fine at 5 years out, which to me suggests, okay, that works for a lot of parents. Maybe it helps the mothers and the fathers get some sleep and there's emotional stability in the family. That's a good thing.
I would agree with that. And there was some other research that you could argue is contradictory in the University of North Texas, published in Early Human Development last year, looking at 25 babies ages 4 to 10 months doing a 5-day inpatient sleep training program where they followed them and found higher cortisol levels in their saliva, and I don't know what I think about all this, but
the babies actually appeared to the outside observer or to their parents as falling asleep quicker, which is kind of ironic here. They were actually looking to their parents that they were better, but yet the researchers maybe measuring someone's saliva on a child is stress producing in and of itself. But I think that, you know, both groups of parents, this is one of those ones where they could both possibly be right. What do you think?
I agree with you. I think this is complex and has a lot to do with your personal values, your family values, and how you and your family decide that you want to approach some of this within a range of normal, as long as you're responding to your baby who could be caught in the crib or could be hungry and changing diapers and those basic needs are met. I think it's a really personal decision, and this evidence would support that they probably turn out fine either way.
What I used to tell my wife, Christy, I don't know if I should admit this on the air, but I used to say, you know what, by the time our daughter's 18, she'll no longer probably be crying throughout the night.
Well,
and that was the solace we had. And then somewhere along the way, it went away.
My kids are fine, I hope. There'll be other things I'm sure I did very wrong, but I think you have to find your way, and that giving them some consistent love allows you to try to hopefully just to support each other in your family through the crying period.
Well, let's avoid crying with our next research that matters, an article that was in the Journal of the American Medical Association about when you get out of the hospital. There's a lot of focus now on keeping you away from coming back into the hospital, but what about going back to the emergency room?
This was some work done by Yale emergency medicine researchers looking to see what percent of patients who leave the hospital return to an emergency or an acute care setting within 30 days. I mean, the answer was nearly 20% of the patients studied returned to that acute care setting.
Yeah, and most of those were within the first 14 days and a very large number in the first 7 days. That's not too surprising at some level, Christy, because you're not in the hospital unless you're really pretty sick. But it is shocking to me in other ways because it suggests, well, when you leave the hospital, shouldn't there be some kind of guarantee that you're going to be okay?
Well, and I think we've shortened hospitalizations over time, and so people aren't just 100% rosy when they leave. And we've got a lot of work to do around transitions from the hospital to home, around medication management, making sure people can get them filled, making sure people know what to take.
So what's your take-home advice when someone's in the hospital to help avoid them coming back to the emergency room within 7 to 14 days? What's the one thing you think they could do?
I think they should ask to go over every medicine before discharge, make sure they understand, and that they should get early appointment with their primary doctor to go back over it all.
And I would say have someone you can talk to in the first 2 or 3 days that you can get on the phone and talk to. both things important. Our very last research that matters, we can probably summarize it pretty quickly, Christy, in Diabetes Care Journal, about if you have a neuropathy, you have painful feet or toes from diabetes, should you be wearing special shoes?
So we do know that people who've had previous foot ulcers or who have problems with the nerves and the feeling of their feet with diabetes should wear these shoes. And the bottom line is most of those people in this study were not wearing them most of the time.
So if you or your loved ones have diabetes and you've got this painful neuropathy in your feet, you probably should not only have these special shoes, you gotta wear them. Well, that'll conclude our research that matters, Christy. We're going to take a short break, though, but when we return, we'll be talking with Dr. Julia Scatliff O'Grady, author of Good Busy and Her Pursuit of Balance. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 FM, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health on WCHL.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, Christy, we're going to be talking with Julia Scatliff O'Grady, author of a new book called Good Busy. And we think this is a really important topic about pursuit of balance and a whole host of potential strategies for being both good and busy. Welcome to our show.
Thanks for having me.
So, Julia, you can imagine Adam and I are eager to learn from you about getting things done and procrastination and the sense of balance. We're hoping you're going to have all the answers for us. So no pressure.
Oh dear.
But tell us what led you to write this book.
Well, I've been fascinated by people's relationship with time almost all of my life. When I first learned about eternity when I was 4 years old, I just panicked. Because
learned about?
Eternity.
Okay.
You know, the concept of eternity.
how old were you?
I think 4 or 5 years old.
Wow.
And then when I learned about heaven and I learned about sitting on a cloud for eternity, I thought that sounded terrible.
Oh.
Because I love getting involved in life and getting out in the world. And I knew that being busy was something that was a non-negotiable for me. But what could be negotiated was whether it was good or bad. And so that's where the title comes from.
And it sounds like you've been planning to write this book for quite some time then.
Yeah, I got started in the world of national service and social entrepreneurship. And I started watching how people dealt with time in that world. And how when you ask people to volunteer, often they'd say they didn't have enough time. And that question just really flummoxed me. And I thought about how it is that some of us feel we have the time for things in our lives and how others struggle to get it. So I started to lead seminars and work with people around their relationship. I went to a lot of time management seminars, and I found them so tedious and difficult. I think in our culture, we see busyness as something that you need some sort of expertise to deal with it. And yet, I don't think it's a matter of expertise. I think it's a matter of daily due diligence.
Hmm. Well, there's this assumption, because I've gone to these time management, and as physicians, we are constantly under the pressure to do more with less time, to be more time efficient, as you say. And that's, it seems as if you're almost have this infinite expansion of what to do, and yet a contracting sense of time. And that pressure is very intense. Is that in part the sorts of things
you're facing? I couldn't agree
more.
And I think many of the things that we as individuals struggle with, we have no idea that this is actually something rooted in our history as a nation, that in the early 20th century, there were a group of people who formed the efficiency movement, and they worked hard to figure out how hard can we work people and still get things done properly. And so this notion of being efficient is a part of our sense of being citizens, our sense of waking up every morning and being productive. And while I think it's crucial to feel a sense of productivity, as you alluded to earlier, you don't want to kill yourself along the way. You don't want to hurt your own health by trying to get things done. And so that's what I've sought by writing about 10 different practices that were organic. I listened and listened to people in interviews, and I'd hear one word over and over again: buffer, Gungi, sliver.
We're going to have to dive into these. Tell us about this very first one, because those who have not read this book yet by Julia Scatliff O'Grady called Good Busy do need to get a copy, because it's just chock full of stories, and we won't be able to do justice to all of those stories or even a glimmer. But help us, let's go through some of these. Buffer. Tell us what buffering is, and how did you come across this one?
Well, each of the 10 people featured in the book came to me in different ways. Buffer came as a result of my first year in college roommate, who I'm still friends with. She's always on time, and I always struggle with punctuality. You can imagine the difficulty of me being a time management leader and struggling to get to my own session on time. That's kind of the case. You know, I'm fascinated by time. She had no trouble. So she taught me that by putting a margin around everything that you do, building more space into your day, you have a chance of greater calm. Balance doesn't come just by wishing it so. Balance comes by thinking deliberately about it. So Kari puts a buffer not only into her appointments, into her life, she buffers other people. With me, she knows I might be about 10 minutes late somewhere, so she'll tell me to show up 10 minutes early.
We've got a friend like that. We're not going to say her or his name.
Yeah. And when I write about this in the book. We were in a car together. She buffers between cars. She doesn't get so close to cars. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, there was this enormous accident right in front of us, but she had buffered. She saved our lives because she created space.
Well, and I have felt that before, where that feeling where you have so much on your plate that you can't, that one more thing might just make you feel like you can't handle it, versus having just a little bit of extra space where you can deal with the unpredictable parts of your day. What about having a routine, particularly for people who might have jobs or children or life that doesn't always follow into a routine?
Well, again, many of these practices are my greatest struggle. I will be very honest about that. Routines are difficult for me as well. The second chapter of the book is about routine, and it is inspired by Mr. Rogers, who was the boss of a friend of my sister's. And so I went up to Pittsburgh and met with Joe a couple years after Mr. Rogers had passed away. And he talked about how Mr. Rogers was always the same on screen as off. He had a beautiful routine in his own daily life. I'm getting goosebumps just thinking about it. He had a routine in his own daily life, waking up at 4, working for several hours, swimming, and then going back to work. But he always made time to talk with people. His routine wasn't so rigid that he shut off the people who he cared about the most.
Well, I can see routine helping to structure a day that makes it productive. I think that, you know, one of the things is how much time many of us can waste or not really doing what we want to do, but doing what's maybe in front of us. And routines can really help in that, whether that's in work or prayer or anything. How does it help in the goodness of the busy? Because the title of your book is Good Busy. How do routines help in that kind of goodness part? Because getting up at 4 in the morning does not sound to me good. But I stay, and part of it because I stay up, and in your book, you do too, stay up pretty late. So staying going to bed at midnight is not going to get up at 4 a.m.
Well, listen, I think there are some realities about our bodies that in the modern, postmodern era, we have forgotten about. So having a sense of when you probably should go to bed, when you should probably wake up, when you need to eat, and having those as markers in your day is crucial. I think it's also a way for you to remember yourself in the midst of all of the chaos around you. We have so many demands that are put upon us that if you can say to someone, you know, I really need to be home at 5:30, that's important. It's important to hold true to those aspects of the routine that make you feel stronger.
And we are going to need to take a short break soon, but how does that relate to this mirror and paying attention to yourself and paying attention to what's going on?
Well, that's a wonderful question, because often when we pay attention to other people, we can sometimes forget about ourselves. So with the mirror was inspired by my bus driver, who I, every time I rode the bus home from school, this is just a few years ago, I'd sit and talk with her. And as she talked to me, she'd be looking out the side mirrors, the rearview mirrors, all the mirrors. I don't know if you've looked on a bus, but there are a lot of mirrors to take care of and so many people to take care of in her vehicle. So it really inspired this sense of how, yes, we need to take care of ourselves, but we also have to think about how we take care of others while we're here on the planet. And she struggles with that, you know, because if you are a bus driver, as she is, she's got shifts from 11 p.m. to 4 a.m., starting to drive the bus again at 7 a.m. Some of us have greater control of our time than others, and people who are working shift work don't have as much control as those of us who can kind of show up when we are ready to work and leave when we need to.
Yeah, I know when I talk frequently with medical students that may shadow us in the office, frequently I say, okay, we're going to see in and out of people's lives in snippets of time. And one thing you'll have to deal with is how you feel in and out. And this mirror is to make sure that your feelings don't intrude upon the very next encounter. But you have to take care of yourself, because you may see 10 or 12 in a half day very important lives like you're sharing with us. Well, we're going to take a short break, but when we return, we'll continue talking with our guest, Julia Scatliff O'Grady, about her new book, Good Busy. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health on 97.9 FM WCHL.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We have been having a fascinating conversation with Julia Scatliff O'Grady about her new book, Good Busy, and talking about productivity, procrastination, the pursuit of balance. And she has these 10 stories that are really poignant about day-to-day life and how for us to think about time a little differently. Thanks for continuing the conversation, Julia.
No, you're welcome.
And, you know, you have a chapter called Sliver, and it really, I relate to it a lot, and it's about moving beyond procrastination. And it's this sense of, I do the thing that I least want to do last. And because I do it last, I frequently don't choose not to do it at a certain time until it becomes a crisis. Talk to us about Sliver, because I think this is a really practical suggestion that you offer that I really like. I'm going to adopt it.
Well, thank you. All of these words, I hope, stand in for long formulas and forms, that they're words that just pop into your head and remind you that it's time to sliver.
Right, and that's what I liked about it. It's a time to sliver. Tell us what that is.
Well, Sliver was inspired by Tom Rankin, who's head of the Center for Documentary Studies over at Duke. And he has kind of an irreverent managerial style. He conducts meetings out in the hallway, and he lives by the sliver, that if there's an opportunity to get something done or to have a conversation, you don't wait. You have it right then. So slivering is both doing things that you've been putting off and you find kind of icky. It's also maybe doing something first that you've wanted to do for a while that you feel it's just too much fun. You've got to get the other stuff done first. So slivering is just really bringing things into your life that have been in holding.
So it could either be the thing you don't want to do or the thing you're most excited about, but it's being intentional about what you do first or what you do with the opportunity?
Yes. I don't know that there's a first or a last, but there's more. Think about all those things that are just kind of dying on the vine in your life.
Uh-huh.
You say you want to do X, Y, or Z, but it just is waiting for you to come grab it.
Nice. That helps me rethink couple things as well.
Well, and I like the fact it's not about did you succeed in that long-term whatever. It's just did you start it?
Yes.
And so that success is made from the actual act of starting it, the act of doing it. And it's wonderful.
Well, speaking of long term, one of your stories is called geological, or taking the long view. Help us understand what you mean.
Geological time was inspired by my friend Alex, who I met when he was 18 years old. So I've known him a long time. And he always feels that people think that he's slow. And for him, it's more that he just chooses those two or three things that are important right now. Like staying married to my wife, loving my children, not reading the newspaper until the kids are a certain age, just realizing that there's enough time in life to do what matters. So why try to cram it every day with all that you think you're supposed to do?
Yeah, and you talk about how he and others can set goals, and whether those goals are daily goals, I guess, or monthly or lifelong goals, but it helps keep you focused that whatever happens today is not going to determine who you are always. It can be those overall goals.
Absolutely. You know, I always have this image. This isn't Alex, but this is mine. You know, you're at the Museum of Life and Science and you see the dinosaurs from way back when. We have no idea what they were doing every day. Nor will people 2,000 years from now, I don't think, know about exactly what we were doing today. So it lends some perspective to know that we are just a little... We're a powerful blip, but we're a blip.
Yeah. Well, and you also, you talk about blips. There are things in our lives that aren't blips. You know, life happens. Events happen. I mean, I'm sure if Christy and I were to get into the things that we're dealing with now or that you are in our families alone, it sometimes is overwhelming. And you use the word gungy to keep going. Why is that important to keep going in the face of overwhelming things in life for good busy?
Well, gungy was a word that came up in an interview with Esther, who is a bartender in Las Vegas. And what I find so moving about this practice is that it's not about becoming necessarily more competent or better at prioritizing. It's about enduring and realizing that things change when they're ready to change. And in the meantime, it's best just to be patient and to keep going. And she's had some difficult things happen in her life, some gungy. The gungy is still present. And yet she's able to take on that perspective that the world is still beautiful.
That is a beautiful concept and so important for us to reflect on. The other one that is fun to just say is milk your cows. You have a chapter called Milk Your Cows or Reckoning with Your Responsibilities.
And I suspect this is about being on a farm.
You got it.
That's right. We can all relate to that.
Tell us about the farm girl.
Well, I knew I wanted to write a chapter on dependency, people who depend on you and what that means with regard to time management. Because you can't exactly say, well, I'm going to spend 2 hours with my sick mother today, and then maybe 3 weeks from then I'll be able to wean her off my love a little bit, you know?
That doesn't work?
You know, our dependents are our children, our plants, our animals, our parents. Some of them, we need to see them every day. So a friend of mine said, well, why don't you go see this dairy farmer? Because he has to milk his cows every day. There's no question asked. You know,
nice,
they'll
burst. Yes.
And so can you apply this vision to your relationships with other humans?
Yeah, that's so important and so poignant. And so how do you take that forward in your own ways, and how do you apply that in ways that allow you to kind of practice good busy? Because I think this is about practicing good busy, isn't it?
Well, I have a couple children. I have an 11 and a 13-year-old who have watched me through this process, who came to every reading in the fall, who asked questions of me. And I'm keenly aware that they are changing every day and that they need me in different ways. I dedicated the book to my father, who is the original busy man still at 85. He's a physician at UNC hospitals and still is a clinician.
We should be honest, a very, very well-known, famous kind of a figure of the radiology of UNC, the face of radiology.
He is. And so there's the chapter on Hunt, about hunting for how you are busy. How are you genetically constructed to be busy? And I'm so much like my father. And I wrote about this in the book. I still remember as a child walking through the halls with him at a fast clip. And he still walks through with that fast clip.
I like that. I like him.
Yeah. So this sense of my mother passed away a year ago, and she has affected my busyness. And like the Milk Your Cows chapter, she needed me and I needed her, and I made space for that.
Well, I know our listeners, as well as Adam and I, have learned a great deal from this conversation, and I imagine you can find your book by Googling or going to Amazon to find Good Busy. What would you leave our listeners with as sort of the most important thing in your reflections about having good busy?
Well, number one, there's really no such thing as balance. It lasts for maybe 2 seconds. So we are constantly in a process of leveling ourselves.
It's not a checky box.
There's no destination in balance. So that's one thing. Number two, you can go to time management seminars. I think people find them helpful. I think if we just keep the conversation going among ourselves, we'll learn even more.
Well, we want to thank you so much for helping us learn more and enriching our listeners for your health. Thank you for joining us today.
Oh, you're welcome. I enjoyed it.
We've been talking with Julia Scatliff O'Grady about her book, Good Busy. We're going to take a short break, but when we return, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. Your health continues now.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Adam and I get to spend a few minutes giving you our take about your health questions and concerns. We've got some good ones today, Adam.
We do. And if you have a question you want us to address, send your comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. And we're going to have the final word about flu this year, maybe.
Maybe. Okay, so we're going to talk about flu, cochlear implants.
Cochlear implants. Mm-hmm. We'll have to define even what that means.
About testicles.
Babies, not babies just, and the testicles. Yep. And those are important things. And when it goes awry.
And about arthritis and relationship to the weather. Good questions.
Yeah, all over the place here. Let's start with this very first one. This has been a nasty flu season, Christy. And, you know, what I've heard a lot, unfortunately, from my relatives is, well, you know, Adam, all our friends who get the flu got a flu shot. Why is that?
Well, and some people who think, oh, the flu shot caused the flu, which there's lots of evidence to say it doesn't cause the flu. But in this case, and this year, we've had lots of patients at our clinic who got the flu shot appropriately and then somehow managed to get the flu.
Well, we know that the flu shot is only about 60% effective mm-hmm. in preventing that year's flu in most circumstances. And some people say, oh, well, if it's only 60% effective, I'm not going to get it. But on the other hand, that's better than a lot of things than we have as far as many tools.
It is. And I mean, that range of 60 to 70% effective is based on the factors of your health and your age of the person getting the vaccine, as well as this match between the vaccine itself and the strains that are going around that given year. And, you know, our scientists in our country have to predict which strains are likely to go around. So there's some room for error there. Most of my patients who've gotten it, and my family who did get it, we had milder versions. And I believe that's because we did get the flu shot.
Yeah, I think the real question is, do you get the flu shot and you develop severe flu, where you're in the bed for 2 weeks or you're in the hospital. And that can happen, certainly. But for the vast majority of people who get a flu shot, they either have a very mild case of the flu or they can prevent getting the flu. So we're strongly, matter of fact, I would still say when you hear this, if you hadn't gotten your flu shot, we still maybe have another month, not too late. Boy, it's been a tough season.
It sure has. Get your flu shot and be sure to get it next year, too.
Let's talk about our very next house call, Christy, that has to do with cochlear implants. And we should probably define exactly what that is, because most people would say that's not a good thing, but this might be. What do you think?
Well, let's listen to our question.
Yeah.
I just got a cochlear implant at UNC, and I can't wait to get it all hooked up and working. One question I'm eager to know is if I'll be able to sing and hear music like I could as a younger man. What do you predict?
Well, this is about someone who clearly has hearing loss. And the question is a cochlear implant or an insertion of a medical device that can help restore hearing, is it worthwhile for most people who suffer a particular type of hearing loss that this might correct?
And these things are amazing. I got to watch them be placed a little bit when I was in medical school. And the transformation that patients have to be able to hear is pretty impressive in many cases, particularly for people who had some hearing and ability to distinguish sounds and speak before they had their hearing loss. It has been very effective.
Now, will you be able to sing and hear music like you could when you were younger? I'm not going to go that far. There's very few things that you can do as well when you're older as you could when you're younger, like physical activity. Some decline is natural. But can you hear so that you'll enjoy things that you couldn't have heard otherwise? Absolutely.
And can you sing as well as you could as when you were a younger man?
We're not going to go on that one.
But it is true that at first that sound, people say it comes across more mechanical, but after 8 weeks or so, it becomes more natural. And so certainly we are excited for you that this might improve your hearing and quality of life. And I sure hope you get that singing voice just as well as you ever had it.
Well, Christy, you can sing just as nice now as you could 4 years ago when we started doing the show.
I'm trying. It's getting worse. It's definitely coming down.
That may be that kid thing. But anyhow, maybe we'll get Christy to sing one time on the show a little bit more. She's got a beautiful voice. Well, let's talk about our next house call about an unfortunate circumstance around the delivery of their new baby.
I have a friend who just delivered a new baby boy. Her baby had normal genitals, but did not have testicles. The doctor ordered an ultrasound, which showed they were in the baby's stomach near the kidneys. The doctor called a pediatric urologist, and that doctor said the ultrasound was not necessary in the first place. Who is right?
Well, this is a very difficult situation. And first off, you know, we all look forward so much to deliveries that are quote unquote normal. And yet things that are a little bit abnormal happen a fair amount of the time. So thank you for sharing that with us.
Definitely. And, you know, it's pretty common that people are like, count their fingers and toes. And often people, you know, want to go ahead and check and make sure all their body parts are there. And to have those testicles not there is concerning. It would be concerning to me as a parent. And as a physician, I would want to know if they're really not able to be found anywhere. I would certainly want to order an ultrasound and know where they could be located for a couple of reasons.
Yeah, and many times, you know, the parent may not pick this up. This may have been picked up and probably was picked up by the family practice physician or the pediatrician examining the child in the newborn nursery. And so then, you know, to be told, but the vast majority of the times, the testicles are kind of up a little bit higher, but actually can come down on their own into the right place. They just haven't kind of descended, kind of like that Times Square ball. It hasn't really come down. It got stuck halfway coming down for New Year's Eve. You know what's going to come on down once you kind of get everything in right in place.
Right. And that's common with premature babies especially. But in this case, when they're so high near the kidneys, it's important to know because for testicles that don't descend and come down into the scrotum, they are at higher risk for having testicular cancer later in life. And so surgically, we will go ahead around 6 months or so and bring them down into the scrotum.
And there could also be other problems relating to other genetic issues. And so the genetic testing needs to occur because sometimes things occur in more than just one thing mm-hmm. that goes awry or amiss here. So thank you for sharing this with us. We hope that the surgery goes well here and that there is nothing else amiss here. And this will be helpful for all of our listeners who may be having similar sorts of problems with children or grandchildren. Thank you.
Absolutely. Let's take our last house call question.
I've got a question for your health. Is arthritis weather sensitive?
Well, people swear by this, Christy.
I know, they sure do. I mean, this is very, very common as something we hear from our patients, that the weather, particularly changes in weather when it's more humid and cold, that it hurts their arthritis.
Or they can say that the rainstorm is coming.
They know there. Because their knees hurt.
Yep, and I am not about to get into an argument with any of my patients on this one, Christy, but I will say that the data is not so good about saying that this is actually really what happens here. There is some scientific basis for this, maybe.
There is that some thought that there's the decrease in barometric pressure may cause some swelling or expansion.
Like a balloon that expands
joints.
When you lower the pressure.
Mm-hmm. But nobody really understands, and there is some conflicting data, scientific data, about whether or not this is true and what the explanation would be. But I agree with you, Adam. It is such a common complaint that I have a hard time believing it's not true. I just think doctors haven't figured it out yet.
Yeah. I mean, when it's cold outside, if you've got that Raynaud's, those painful fingertips and toes, when it gets cold outside, your fingers and toes get more painful. So we know that there's certain things like that. But boy, if you can tell me when it's going to rain, I want to know about it. And we do hope that, in all seriousness, that, you know, that the pain that you feel is real. So some people move to warmer climates to actually mm-hmm. because of arthritis.
And we hope that you can work with your doctor to figure out some treatment plans to help relieve your pain.
Well, thank you, Christy. I think that's our concluding words on our house calls today. And for all of those who send in questions, we appreciate those. And anyone else can send us in questions at yourhealth@unc.edu.
We want to thank you for joining us today for Your Health. We hope we've addressed some issues and concerns that are important to your health, and we want you to share. Email us at yourhealth@unc.edu. Visit us online at yourhealthradio.org. You can follow us on Twitter, Facebook, iTunes. Get our new health app. Lots of people are listening in the health app now.
Yeah, I listen to it that way.
I do too.
And we'd like to thank WCHL, UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our guest today, Dr. Julia Scatliff O'Grady. We hope you join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And we'll look forward to talking with you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM, WCHL, presented by UNC Family Medicine. You can find this or any other episode of Your Health at WCHL's website, chapelboro.com. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM, WCHL, Chapel Hill Carborough's news, talk, and Tar Heel station.